Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. There's this thing on Twitter. It's called ratioing. Basically, it means if you tweet something and you get a lot more replies than likes or retweets, then people really loathe what you had to say. I mean, really, really loathe what you had to say. The National Rifle Association told doctors this week to stay in their lane after a physicians group pushed for greater gun control. The NRA tweet got 3,000 likes and about 22,000 replies, many of them angry, many outraged. Among them was Dr. Julie Melinek, a forensic pathologist. That means she often pulls bullets out of dead bodies. A lot of them. Melinek tweeted back to the NRA that gun violence isn't just her lane, it's her highway. Only she used a modifier brought to you by the letter F. A flood of other doctors, nurses, and others too responded with the viral meme hashtag, "This is my lane." Dr. Melinek explained why.
For us working in the trenches in America's hospitals and morgues, we're seeing the day-to-day carnage that occurs as a result of gun violence. So when the NRA tweeted out that doctors should stay in their lane, I was just incensed.
This hour on Point, MDs versus the NRA. You can join us. How has gun violence affected your communities? And how would greater gun control affect your rights and your safety? We're particularly interested in hearing from medical professionals this hour who are on all sides of the issue. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. We're going to start with Lois Beckett. She's joining us from Berkeley, California. Lois is senior reporter with The Guardian. Her beat incorporates guns, gun violence, criminal justice, and for good measure, the far right. Hey, Lois, good to have you here.
Great to talk with you.
So give us a little bit of context. Sketch this out for us. It's been kind of a brutal stretch, a few days, when it's come to the issue of guns. And the anger and backlash occurred in a specific context, a specific time frame. Help us walk through that.
So what we're having here is a debate between doctors and the National Rifle Association that has been especially fierce in the wake of two really brutal mass shootings. More than a dozen people dead, 11 people dead in Pittsburgh. And also an atmosphere in this country where only 11 people dead in a mass shooting seems like sort of ordinary now, whereas a decade or two ago, that would have been unthinkable. That would have dominated the news cycle for months. And now we're coming off of 2 years in which there have been so many mass shootings and so many people have died that this no longer seems like something for which the news cycle stops anymore. I know that's hard for us in newsrooms covering these shootings. And I know for readers and listeners, it's hard for them to watch and see as well.
I mean, when you talk about the shootings, I mean, we should remind people because, weirdly, even though it's very recent, it needs reminding. I mean, you had the shooting at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. You have this report that we'll be talking about from the American College of Physicians. The NRA tweets. And then there's the Thousand Oaks event, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I think what's really interesting here and what might not be obvious, even for this latest generations of physicians speaking out, is that this battle between doctors and the National Rifle Association, this incredibly charged and heated debate over whether it's appropriate to call gun violence a public health crisis, has been going on for more than two decades. And this is a pitched battle that started in the mid-1990s when doctors first started to say gun violence and other kinds of injury, as well as disease, these are something that we can use, that we can look at in a public health lens, not just through criminal justice or policing, but we can think of how that we can treat these things and stop the transmission of violence as if it were a disease. And this is something from the early 1990s when there was more public health research started on this that the NRA has pushed back extremely fiercely, doing everything they can in Congress to block physicians and other medical professionals from claiming this as their issue.
Can you tell me, like, you know, there's this flashpoint on social media. Is that a flash in the pan or is that reflective of something enduring? Have people been activated to talk publicly, maybe more prominently than they once did?
So that's a really good question. I mean, I think there is a tendency to look at social media as something, and especially on dunking on organizations like the NRA, as something that is performative and maybe not as meaningful as sort of other kinds of action. But it's also true that, you know, by getting started, by doing a viral tweet or by publicly expressing your opinion about something, that can be a first step for people to get involved. It can activate them. It can show them that this is something that they might want to be involved with. And so that's, I think, something that's really important to watch is, okay, so you got a viral tweet. Like, what happens next? You know, one thing within the community of gun violence researchers that has been a little bit frustrating is Mike Siegel, who's a researcher at Boston University School of Public Health, noted that the American Medical Association and the American College of Physicians have put out these papers decrying gun violence and asking for gun control, but quietly they're still donating money to congressional candidates who are backed by the NRA. And so he's really pushing these organizations to really put their money where their mouth is and stop donating to members of Congress who are blocking gun laws.
And can you give us a feel? I mean, my recollection is that all kinds of major crime has come down significantly since the 1990s, and that homicides are among them, notably among them, even if there's been a slight dip up, and that gun-related deaths as well. Where are we in that? How, you know, we've seen some really upsetting, incredibly horrific incidents that have taken multiple lives. And yet, as a general question of the flow of gun-related homicides, how bad is it?
So it's really tricky because if you ask in public opinion surveys, is gun violence worse now than it used to be? Americans will almost always say yes. There's always the perception that it's getting worse and that America is more violent. But we are absolutely safer today as a country in terms of gun homicides and shootings than we were at the peak of the gun violence epidemic in 1993. The nation's gun murder rate is down by about half. So it's true that in 2015 and 2016, we saw some troubling increases in murders going to now sort of close to 14,000 gun homicides a year. So, you know, about an increase of about 4,000 from sort of 2011, 2012, and that gun suicides are also increasing. So that is troubling, but we are still nowhere close to the levels of the 1990s. Where we are now, according to FBI and CDC data, is that the decreases in murders and gun violence that we saw at the beginning of the Obama administration have been erased. So we're sort of back where we are around 2009.
I want to point out, and I'll do so later again in the hour, we invited representatives of the National Rifle Association several times to join us, and they did not take us up on those offers. We do have joining us now, however, from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Dr. Rebecca Cunningham. She's director of the Injury Center at the University of Michigan Medical School. She's also the assistant vice president of research, an emergency physician, a professor of emergency medicine. Dr. Cunningham, great to have you on the show.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk to you as you know, somebody who actually treats these things, researches these things, but also somebody, if I'm remembering correctly, who may well have tweeted bloody scrubs, you know, pictures that you saw from many physicians online in recent days. What moved you to get involved in this?
Sure. I did not tweet out the bloody scrubs, but I did tweet about this Twitter discussion a fair amount. So I'm an emergency physician and practicing, and like many emergency physicians, have been in the trenches and seen the daily toll of gun violence on children and teens and adults over the last 20 years that I've been practicing. Mm-hmm. And these are daily occurrences. You know, as was mentioned before, over 100 lives every day are lost to gun violence, 2/3 of those by suicide. 10 children a day in America die of gun violence. And in and out every day, those are a lot of trauma bays across and emergency departments across the country where physicians are spending a good portion of their day in teams with their hands very bloody and looking at trying to save these young lives, often hopelessly. We see the tremendous toll, and those stories came out with outrage, certainly this past weekend. Because with right so, we're standing there every day in and out with surgeons and respiratory folks and nurses and seeing this carnage. And although, as rightly noted by your guest, there are some decreases In some statistics, although I don't know that the country really realizes that gun violence is the second leading cause of death among our children and our adolescents. And that number has been static for at least 10 years. So although the numbers may be down, I'm not sure that we should find it acceptable yet that that only second to car crash, this is a leading cause of death among our children. And for our children that live in minority communities and our African-American children, this is the most likely thing that they will die from before their 20th birthday, before their 19th birthday, before their 18th birthday. And this just isn't acceptable to the physicians that are standing in and out daily, telling mothers in quiet waiting rooms who are just stunned, delivering this horrific news, so frustrated that yet another young life has been taken.
Thanks for that, Rebecca. I want to take a quick call before our first break. Jay is calling from New Orleans. Jay, go ahead.
Thank you for this topic. I am a gun owner most of my adult life. I strongly disagree with the NRA on many, if not most, of their positions when it comes to any type of logical, rational discussion. One specific medical point I'd like to point out is that among the arguments and NRA members I know will say, well, an assault rifle, an AR-15, it's the same as a handgun. You shouldn't treat it any different. And that's a bald-faced lie. You know, an AR-15 bullet is about the size of a .22. But the shell is three times as large, the muzzle velocity is three times as much, and it causes just exponentially more dangerous injuries. I'd like your guests to comment on that, specifically just about the impact and, you know, how much more dangerous a round from an assault rifle is from a standard handgun. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Jay. I'm going to go to Lois Beckett. We only have about 15, 20 seconds for you, but give us a response to that, please.
That is, when you talk to surgeons and emergency medical technicians, they'll talk about that these are really small bullets, but they're bouncing around in the body, causing incredible damage.
And you're hearing the insight this hour of medical professionals on the question of gun violence and gun safety. We're talking about the decision of the American College of Physicians, a leading group to call it a public health crisis, demand fresh action, and their reaction to the NRA when being told that doctors should stay in their lane. Our guests are going to join us. We want you to join the conversation. Can we maintain Second Amendment rights in this country and still solve this as a public health crisis? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the backlash in the medical profession to the NRA telling doctors to stay in their lane. Doctors then created the viral meme, "This is my lane." You can join our conversation. Is gun violence an epidemic that we can solve? How to balance that violence with the history of protection for gun ownership in this country. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. You're going to be hearing this hour from medical professionals as well as a leading journalist on this issue. But we should also briefly hear, I think, from a survivor. Susan Orphanon's son was murdered in the Thousand Oaks shooting out in California not too many days ago. And she at that time told reporters she doesn't want any more thoughts and prayers.
My son was in Las Vegas with a lot of his friends, and he came home. He didn't come home last night, and I don't want prayers. I don't want thoughts. I want gun control, and I hope to God nobody else sends me any more prayers. I want gun control. No more guns.
My guests today are Lois Beckett of The Guardian, Dr. Rebecca Cunningham, director of the Injury Center at the University of Michigan Medical School. And joining us from Austin, Texas, is Dr. Sue Bornstein. She's an internal medicine specialist, and she's co-author of this recent updated position paper sent out by the American College of Physicians. She says she's also a gun owner and a hunter. Dr. Bornstein, thanks for joining us.
Hi, David. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit, walk through just very quickly some of the positions that the College of Physicians is taking and some of the new stances that this updated paper reflects.
Well, thank you, and thanks for the opportunity to share our work. The American College of Physicians, which is the largest medical specialty society in the world, comprised of internal medicine physicians and internal medicine specialists, we have over 150,000 members nationally and internationally. And for the last 20 years or more, we have had a longstanding policy aimed at preventing firearms injuries and deaths as part of our commitment to advocate for public health. We wrote a paper in 2014 outlining some what we believe are common sense, practical approaches to reducing gun injuries and death. And this paper, this recent paper, really updated those positions. So the new positions include strengthening laws to prohibit domestic violence offenders from purchasing or possessing firearms. Also, we call for red flag or immediate danger laws, which some states have, but not all states do. Another important new recommendation is that we call for really nationwide child access prevention laws that would hold firearm owners accountable for the safe storage and handling of their firearms. And we also oppose laws that would force concealed carry reciprocity between states. Another thing that has happened, I think our paper, one of the reasons we needed to update it is because of the technology that has been advancing in terms of firearms manufacture and distribution and things like weapons that cannot be detected by typical means through the TSA. And what I'm talking about here specifically is the types of handguns that can be produced by a 3D printer. So we call for a ban on those as well. And also things that enhance the rapid firing ability of especially high-powered weapons such as bump stock. So we call for a restriction of those as well.
So I want to take – our calls are lighting up. Lighting up, folks. And so I want to take a couple of them. We have a call from Sandusky, Ohio. Cameron, go ahead.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me on the show. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to share personal difficulties I've been having with the NRA. As a family physician, it is important to talk to parents about gun storage safety and gun safety, especially if they're children at home. And the NRA has been pushing legislation very heavily so that doctors are not permitted to have this conversation with patients. And it's been very frustrating to think that safety itself has some sort of political agenda when it really doesn't. If they ride a bike, I'll ask if they wear a helmet. If they have a pool, I'll ask if they don't swim unsupervised. If you own a gun, I'll just ask that it's stored, locked, and unloaded. And it's just frustrating that they think we're trying to push some sort of political agenda and discourage them from owning guns when really all it's doing is inhibiting us from having a conversation with our patients about just being safe.
Thanks for that, Cameron. I think that's a really interesting point to raise. Rebecca Cunningham, you're a doctor, you're an emergency room physician, you're a researcher on this. How much interference is there or should I say restrictions are there placed on what doctors can talk to patients about when it comes to gun ownership and gun safety?
Sure. So in the past, there have been some regulations around that have been state specific. Those are currently not in existence. So physicians right now have no active restriction about having individual conversations with their patients in the same way, as your caller noted. We talk to them about the temperature of their hot water heater. We talk to them about whether their kid is in a child safety seat or not. And talking to a family of a teenager who has terrible depression about whether or not that teen has access to lethal means in their house is 100% in our lane. And is exactly what our training and our role is in keeping our patients safe. And that's why there was the outrage this weekend on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a call now from Tampa, Florida. Bill, thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Dave. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
First of all, thank the college for making this idea aware, making the awareness. I think that's very important. I grew up in the time of when DWI was the big issue. I'm a retired police officer. And we did a lot of training, and look at all the training over the years that has forced reduction in the DWI problem. The same thing needs to be done with gun safety. I am sickened of the fact that we want to blame guns and not blame the perpetrators or hold the perpetrators responsible. So your question for this hour is, can we do both? Gun rights and gun safety. Yes, we can. It can be done by holding the laws accountable and training at a younger age, everybody, school topic, gun safety. Put those together, we'll get the same results that we have gotten with the DWIs that was really big in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and look at it today. Put the two together, and we can meet the mandate. Just a comment. Thank you.
No, I appreciate your comment. Appreciate your perspective. Lois Beckett, we're definitely going to turn in the third part of the show to possible solutions and places where there might be points of consensus. At the same time, you know, are people being held accountable now, or is attention going to people who are law-abiding citizens who would have their rights infringed as a way of trying to get a handle over this almost unmanageable issue?
So the really difficult thing for Americans about a public health approach to gun violence is that the public health approach is not interested in blaming individual people. It does not think that it is particularly effective to look at the sort of the last person's last action closest to a disaster and saying, how can we punish them or what's wrong with them? Instead, the public health model looks broadly at the entire system and says, how can we change the environment and change the context in which people are working so that it's actually harder for anyone to get to the point where they're in a car crash or where a gun is being used in a violent way. And rather than saying we need to be more punitive, we need to place more blame, it's saying how do we change the design of the roads, change the design of entire systems, change the safety precautions we have in place. And it's very different from the approach that, you know, we're taking now in the United States, which is literally to fortify schools and think about more ways to guard schools from extremely rare school shootings, rather than saying, how do we think more about prevention across the board and making children safer everywhere, rather than trying to protect schools when children are, in fact, almost always, 98% of the time, children who are killed with guns in America are shot outside of school. So we really don't have a scientific approach to gun violence in America right now. Even our debate isn't scientific. And part of that means letting go of these feelings that a lot of us have that want to say guilt, responsibility, individual accountability, and saying that might not actually be the best way to save lives.
Dr. Sue Bornstein, is that right? I mean, should we think about this a bit like vaccinations, where not everybody's going to get the disease, but you're trying to get everybody to get the vaccine?
Absolutely. And I think your other speakers and callers have pointed out very nicely that public health, and again, this is really has been the point of view of the ACP and many other organizations. I should add that the American College of Surgeons, I believe just yesterday, came out with a similar recommendations to ours and American College of Cardiology. So I think you really are seeing a lot of professional associations weigh in. But yes, I think there are a multitude of examples of how a public health approach to improving health and reducing injury and accidents has worked. And some of the folks have said things like seat belts. And think about when I was growing up, that was not a universally used thing. And so think about seat belts have been associated with a decrease in fatalities. Same thing with tobacco. I think that's probably the one that resonates the most with people. Our efforts do have been successful in reducing deaths and illness from smoking. Vaccinations is another example. So, yes, I think this is very consistent with a public health approach, and we have good evidence that it can work.
You know, a lot of this obviously is going to depend on if your recommendations were to be adopted or ones like them depend on politicians and people who make laws and policies in Washington and throughout state capitals. Take a couple of examples. In speaking to CNN last February, Louisiana's Republican Senator John Kennedy told a reporter he didn't think there was any need for more gun control.
I don't think we need more gun control laws.
Not a single one.
No, I think we need more idiot control.
Meanwhile, there have been a number of races across the country in areas red, blue, and purple where gun control rights and people who are at least have an open ear and an open mind to certain kinds of gun control have made some advances. The new congressman-elect from Colorado, Jason Crow, will represent the district that includes Aurora, Colorado. That, of course, was the site of a 2012 mass shooting at a movie theater. Crow focused on calling for gun control, and he beat a Republican rival funded by the NRA.
I grew up hunting deer and duck and rabbit when I was 12 and growing up, and I became an Army Ranger. I used weapons of war at war, and I had them used against me. I know what they're capable of. But way before my political career started and way after it's going to be done, I'm going to be a father. And when my five-year-old daughter comes home from school and talks to me about the bad guy drills that she has to have now and how they have to hide in dark closets, I'm not okay with that. I'm not okay with that being the environment that we raise our children in. And if our leaders aren't willing to do something about it, I was willing to step up and lead from the front.
He's willing, he says, to lead from the front. We've got a call from Newington, Connecticut. John is on the line. John, what's your thought?
Hi, David. I just wanted to say that it's important to understand the goals of the NRA. And whenever they say things like stay in your lane to medical professionals in this country, if you compare the NRA to other Second Amendment rights foundations, like NGOs such as the Second Amendment Foundation, it's clear to see that they're more concerned with spreading right-wing propaganda than with actual gun control or any type of reasonable legislation that would rein in guns. And it's really easy to see that when you compare them to other organizations that are advocates for the Second Amendment.
Thank you so much for that, John. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Lois Beckett, let's talk for a moment about the status and strength of the NRA. It seems as though some folks have come into Capitol Hill that might not be as concerned about them as people once were. It seems as though their financial status may be a little shakier. What's the state of play for them?
So the National Rifle Association's spending on congressional races dropped dramatically compared with 2016 and compared with the 2014 midterm elections. The best overall spending is that gun violence prevention gun control groups spent at least $37 million at the state and federal level on the 2018 elections. And the NRA spent about $20 million on state and federal and just around $10 million on federal races. And what we saw is that the NRA really abandoned House candidates, didn't try to fight for control of the House, and poured most of their money into protecting a relatively small number of Republican senators with the goal of protecting their ability to confirm judges. And the NRA's we've seen reports in recent years that the NRA's membership dues are dropping substantially, that it is in the red with the amount of money that it has spent. And certainly with the student activism since the Parkland school shooting in February of this year, the NRA has faced a grassroots challenge and a kind of backlash and pressure on their financial connections. They're facing there's a lawsuit in New York over regulation of one of their insurance products, which offered insurance for people with concealed carry license if they shot someone. Just on all fronts, the NRA is really embattled in a way that is new for them, certainly over the past 6 years.
Among things we're talking about this hour, the experiences of doctors and their activism here, I want to turn to you, Rebecca Cunningham. Talk about, just for a minute or two before our second break, about what is the toll, what is the experience of treating gunshot victims on such a regular basis for doctors like yourself and for your families?
Sure. So the daily adding up, I think, has been a feeling of helplessness for many physicians over the past 15, 20 years, as they have not seen progress in this lane, so to speak. And that outrage and bottled up, I think, anger over daily taking care of children and our fellow Americans who are basically almost war victims, essentially, in trauma bays across the country is what you saw unleashed this past weekend. You have to realize, with over 100 Americans dying every day by gun violence, every day across the country, there's many physicians and many trauma teams who are faced with very, very unfortunate conversations and going in and telling family members that their loved child is not coming home today. And the inability of them in the past 20 years to be able to really make a lot of movement in that, and injury prevention, has been really frustrating. Although I think that there is hope there, and there are many physicians that have been working to actively change that. And I think part of that conversation is changing this concept that this is really about gun control and rethinking that entire piece. We as physicians know that we don't talk to our patients about car control. We talk to our patients about how to be safe and prevent car crash. And there's very practical things we can do while not riding a horse and buggy, but getting in our cars that we can do to prevent car crash. And in the country, we have prevented many car crashes over the last 25 years. We've seen a tremendous decrease in our patients in trauma bays dying by car crashes. So we need to be thinking about this differently. And physicians are thinking about this differently, thinking about how we're talking about gun safety, how we can talk about gun prevention with our patients, which is very much in our lane, and with physician groups like AFFIRM, which is a nonpartisan cross-political spectrum group who's really activating physicians and was engaged in the signing of the letter last week. And physician groups like ours, the Firearm Safety Among Children and Teens Consortium, which is actively researching ways to do this.
And that's the voice of Rebecca Cunningham. She and other guests will join us. We hope you stay with us for the rest of this hour discussing gun violence, what we can do. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing the roles that doctors and policymakers and even journalists play in figuring out what to do about gun violence. And we're discussing about the role that doctors are playing, particularly after the NRA told them to stay in their lane. A lot of listeners are weighing in. I see David Shield says on Facebook, "I'm a firearm collector. I heard about this on the radio. It doesn't bug me one bit about physicians' involvement. If your excuse to defend firearms is always going to be mental health, well, guess who treats it? That's why doctors. The truth is the whole, so that all sides should participate without politics having to be introduced." We also have a call here from Tampa, Florida. Andrew, go ahead.
Thanks, David. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I think mental health really is the issue. There's a lot of rural areas, particularly in the Midwest, that just don't have access to mental health facilities and whatnot. And I think another issue, particularly in the Midwest, once again, in these rural areas, and you see a lot of these shootings occur in these rural areas, too, is these people have every other gunshot I hear about is these people had prior mental health issues, yet somehow they obtained a gun. So I think it's a combo of two things. I think we definitely need more access to mental health. That includes removing the stigma, which is huge here in the United States, and giving more people access to the mental health facilities. And also, you know, some common sense gun laws, like maybe a background check at a gun show, so someone who has prior mental health issues can't just walk into a gun show and get a weapon.
Well, let me get Sue Bornstein in here, and thank you so much for that, Andrew. Sue Bornstein was co-author of the recent position paper from the American College of Physicians. It seemed to me, Sue, that the college kind of stepped very warily and carefully around the issue of mental illness, and it's treated very delicately. Explain what you were trying to navigate there.
Well, I think Andrew brings up an excellent point, and I'm actually glad that he did. And in fact, the college has strong positions about this, and that is, it's very easy, I think, to default and say, well, the problem is mental illness. And in fact, the research and statistics would show that actually there's a very small subset of people with severe and persistent mental illness that, in fact, are perpetrators of firearms violence. However, and he is absolutely correct, is that access to behavioral health, mental health services is a big challenge in this country, as he's pointed out, in rural areas, but really in every part of the country. There's simply not enough people that are providing mental health services. There are not enough hospitals and the like. The other thing I would point out, so having said that people with persistent serious mental illness are a small subset of people that actually commit firearms violence, the same is not true about suicide. And I really want to underline the fact that nearly 22,000 Americans die by firearm suicide every year. As a matter of fact, the Center for Disease Control last week and alarmingly reported that there was a 21% increase in suicide in this country in the 10 years between 2005 and 2015. And so firearms are used in less than 6% of suicide attempts, but over half suicide deaths are with firearms. And so this, I think, when we just talk about mental health, this is really where we need to focus our attention. This also brings up the issue of waiting periods, and there's debate about whether waiting periods really can reduce the injury and death. But there have been studies that have shown that with respect to suicide, waiting periods may potentially reduce suicides because it can be an impulsive decision, and ready access to firearms can increase the lethality. So yes, access to mental health services with special emphasis on understanding and reducing suicide.
I want to take a call now from Flag Pond, Tennessee. Grover, go ahead.
Hi, David.
Come on. Good day.
A little interesting fact with physicians talking about the need, considering firearms death as a national health issue. In either 2000 or 12, an interesting statistic, 9,600 some odd people died in one form or another of gunshots, whether that's hunting, suicide, all types of gun deaths. Mm-hmm. That same year, 250,000 people were killed by doctors and hospitals in this country. The need for control is a need for better trained doctors and hospitals. And for doctors to be trying to claim that this is a health issue, they're living in a glass jar.
Okay, Grover, can I just quickly ask before we let you go, where are you getting the figure from in terms of doctor-caused deaths? Sir? Well, we'll let you go. Thanks, Grover, for that. Let me quickly turn, before we go back to Lois Beckett, let me quickly turn to Sue Bornstein, chair of the American College of Physicians Public Health and Policy Commission. Doctors are not infallible. We know this from people's lives. We know this from, you know, headlines in the paper. What do you make of that question being turned back on you guys?
Well, yes, and I've certainly seen this on social media in the last week. And what I would say to that is, yes, we are not infallible, and it has been recognized for probably the last 10 or 15 years that as medicine and healthcare becomes more complex and the number of interventions, treatments that we have to treat people's illnesses becomes greater, There are concerns about safety. However, I will tell you that organizations such as the IHI, other organizations have really made a strong commitment to improve safety and reduce injury and death from accidents and from incidents like that. So I think they're separate things. We acknowledge that we have work to do, but I will also say that a lot of work has been done.
Mm-hmm. Lois Beckett, one of the things you said, I believe on social media, after the Thousand Oaks shooting, I believe 12 people were killed at that bar in California, was that you were just fed up with people saying it's hopeless and there's nothing that can be done. Actually, it was a great case in which things could have been done and weren't. What did you mean?
So, David, I've been covering the gun debate in America for, this is my sixth year. I started after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in 2012. And one thing that is frustrating is that so often we as journalists frame this question as a debate between the NRA and its opponents and talk about, you know, the fighting and the pushback and, you know, arguments back and forth and, like, can there be middle ground? And I think that actually serves the National Rifle Association, and I think it serves the opponents of change because it makes this a fight story. And there actually are other stories about gun violence in America that are stories of people working together, including gun owners. What was so heartbreaking about the Thousand Oaks shooting is that California, after a 2014 mass shooting that was in many ways very similar to this bar shooting, passed a law called a gun violence restraining order. Law or an extreme risk protection law. This is one of the new policies that the physicians have endorsed in this latest document. And the goal there was that actually law and, you know, it's very hard to define under law or to make a category for when someone might be too dangerous to have guns, you know, there's a lot of middle ground. And so this law allows law enforcement or family members, people who are really close to an individual, to say, listen, I've seen some risk signs. I'm troubled. There may not be enough evidence under law to bar this person from owning firearms forever. But it gives them a way to petition a court and say, I think this person is at risk of harming themselves or other people. Can their guns be taken away temporarily? Can we temporarily block them from buying firearms in this relatively short but in extremely risky period where they may be unstable, they may be depressed, they may be going through something else. And there's been no evidence so far. We don't know whether anyone considered using this in the case of the Thousand Oaks shooter who was troubled, who was constantly fighting with his mother, screaming, shooting into a wall, was creating such a disturbance that his neighbors called the police, and the police came and they said that there was not, that he was evaluated, there was not enough evidence to have him involuntarily committed. But it seems like there was a lot of evidence that something was going wrong. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in this debate, like, a lot of people will say, oh, we need more gun laws, or, oh, we need to enforce the existing laws. But in fact, both of those things are really important. And a lot of people in California still don't know this law exists. Police officers don't know. Family members don't know. And so we are in a situation with gun homicide, with mass shootings, and especially with suicide, where there are ways to save people's lives and people don't know about them. And we as journalists keep covering the massacres and the gore and the violence and the trauma and the grief. And we don't cover the ways that people could stop these things before they happened.
So I just want to very briefly drill down, Lois, because it seems to me as though that's something that you hear sometimes either on the Hill or from NRA representatives or like. They say there are gun laws on the books. People should be enforcing them. You know, they may fight against some of them, but do they have a point?
So I think it's really important in this debate to listen to gun owners and to not frame this crisis as a problem of most gun owners being irresponsible, with which they aren't, or that gun owners need more training or need to be taught how to use their guns properly, which they don't. There's an incredible safety culture within Americans who own guns. So we think that's a really important point. But I think the bigger picture here is that so many people, including gun owners, believe things that are false. Believe, for instance, that there's no way to prevent someone from committing suicide, or, you know, what means you use to commit suicide doesn't matter, where we know that access to guns is actually much more likely to mean that a suicide attempt will be fatal, and that people who commit suicide once and live actually often don't go on to commit suicide again, that this is not an inevitable thing. And one of the best pieces of good news that I've seen over the past couple of years is the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is the representative of the gun industry, working with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention to talk to gun owners at shooting ranges, at gun stores, about how to spot a friend who might be dealing with suicidal thoughts, how to intervene, and how to say, you know, hey, maybe I should take your guns for a while. Maybe you want to store your guns for me for a while you're going through this divorce, while you're going through this depression, just to make you a little safer. That's not about law. That's about gun owners helping each other. And that's a real public health solution. And we don't talk a lot about those things, like we don't talk a lot about suicide, even though those are 2/3 of gun deaths. You know, there are really just good people from all perspectives who are working to save lives. And we tend to give too much attention to the people who are angry and yelling loudly and not the people who are doing the work.
I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. You know, Dr. Rebecca Cunningham, it seems to me as though one of the questions I get at, you know, my day job is I'm also the media correspondent for NPR. So I cover the world of journalism. And one of the questions I get a lot every time something like this happens from a high school classmate, from callers, from listeners, is the question of the media itself, that it gives so much attention both to these incidents and it gives attention to these shooters. And it creates this almost glamorization and demonizing moment at the same time. You know, what do you take from the kind of coverage that you see of such stark events as what happened in Pittsburgh, what happened in Thousand Oaks, Newtown, and elsewhere?
Sure. I think those high-profile events have done a lot to sort of raise awareness across the country that gun violence is a possibility in all of our daily lives, in our yoga studios, and in our places of worship. What doesn't get as much coverage is this daily bloody gun violence that the doctors have been outraged about over this past week, that's happening in and out of regular people's lives that often doesn't get any coverage at all. 50 women a month, every month, die by an intimate partner violent event by gun. Those rarely make the national news. That's more women in a single month than in any one of these shootings. They're both incredibly important and need to be covered, but that discrepancy in the coverage. A few days ago, I had the honor also of seeing some of the youth from a Chicago organization, a youth organization, as well as the March for Our Live Kids, and the discrepancy also in news coverage that happens in urban America. I was a physician in Flint, Michigan, staffing trauma bays there for many years. The gun violence that happens in those communities every day isn't covered nearly to the extent that it is in other communities. And I think that it's important for us to realize and think about the daily toll in all of the settings and to get away from this idea, again, that it's in someone else's backyard. We know, you know, there's as many kids dying in rural America by gun violence, by suicide, as there are in urban America. These are a problem for all of our kids and all of our families. And to the extent that the media can get that message out is really important.
It's been interesting in recent times that I've learned on social media and clicking on the links and reading further that, you know, there's been the question of suicide links to gunshot deaths, and also that you know, domestic violence itself is often a tag for that. That is, there's often a correlation there. It seems as though that this was, for many years, I was a political reporter starting in the late 90s, that this was a red line issue, a third rail issue. You couldn't really touch it and survive electorally. And we are starting to experience at least some signs that maybe people are willing to go there. We heard from Congressman-elect Joe Cunningham. He's a Democrat from the state of South Carolina. He says he's a gun owner, and he does support some additional gun control.
Of course, I got a .40 caliber at home. I've got my concealed weapon permit, support the Second Amendment. I think there can be some common sense, you know, closing the Charleston loophole, background checks. I think these are things that the majority of Americans will accept and agree on.
You know, there have been recent studies that also show that I think figures that might surprise a lot of Americans. 84% of Americans favored closing loopholes for access to guns, according to the Pew Research Center in 2017. That's 90% of Democrats, but also 77% of Republicans. And that Quinnipiac earlier this year polled 97% of Americans found they supported what was described as universal background checks. In just the 40 seconds or so that we have left, Lois Beckett, is there a moment where you could see Americans coming together and figuring out how to address this in ways that both exist now and maybe haven't yet been put into effect?
I think the important thing to realize is if you care about change in Congress, the barrier is not the majority of Americans' opinions. It's Republican primary voters. Their pro-gun control position has determined Republicans' support for this issue in large measure, experts say. And so if you care about gun laws, this is a battle to fight. And gun control advocates are fighting it harder and harder. And they've seen wins this year, but they haven't crossed the line yet.
That's the last word we'll give to Lois Beckett. She's senior reporter with The Guardian. Lois, thank you so much for joining us on this issue.
Thank you.
We've also heard from Rebecca Cunningham. She's director of the Injury Center at the University of Michigan Medical School. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
And we've also had on the line Dr. Sue Bornstein. She's internist and chair of the American College of Physicians Public Health and Policy Committee. She was co-author of the college's recent policy statement on all these issues. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Miriam Wasser. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this show is On Point.